Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. Today we're talking with two filmmakers who have movies in theaters right now. We'll ask Danny Boyle about his new movie, Slumdog Millionaire.
And it's so bizarrely implausible.
And we'll talk to Lance Hammer about his debut film, Ballast.
Were you ever tempted to add music?
I was, I confess.
This is Robert Davis. You know, sometimes I really just don't feel like talking about, writing about, or watching another movie again, you know, ever. Like now, or like recently. Maybe it'd be a good time to just pick up a book or, you know, or even listen to an audiobook. You know, I never figured myself to be an audiobook kind of person, but there are certain authors who I discovered through the radio, you know, David Sedaris and Sarah Vowell come to mind. And so when I read their books, I hear their voices, you know, or at least I try to. And so I finally decided that with this last, most recent David Sedaris book, that I would just get the audiobook and listen to him read it, you know? And it's great. This is the way I'm doing it from now on with David Sedaris. When it comes out with a new book, I'm going to just get the audiobook. It's definitely the way to go. I did the same thing with Sarah Vowell's new book, The Wordy Shipmates. I have it in audio form. I haven't listened to it yet, at least not much of it, so the jury's still out. It's read by the author, at least that's the way it was presented. But listen to how it begins. Listen to this.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Wordy Shipmates by Sarah Vowell. Read by the author.
Yeah, good.
With Eric Bogosian, T-Bone Burnett, Jill Clayburgh, Peter Dinklage, Bill Hader, John Hodgman, Catherine Keener, Tom McCarthy, Dermot Mulroney, John Oliver, Campbell Scott,
and John
Slattery.
Okay.
Original music by Michael Giacchino.
Stop there. Yeah. You know, I don't know if it's just Sarah Vowell's voice maybe needed a little more variation. I don't know. I'll listen to it and I'll let you know how it is. It's probably great. And by the way, as you can tell, I am no one to complain about anyone's voice. I've been sick for what seems like a couple of months, you know, not steadily, but, you know, off and on. I think I'm adjusting to the climate here. I'm readjusting to Midwestern climate after having lived for a decade in California. Well, sometimes I don't feel like talking about movies, but one thing that often cures me of that is sitting down and talking about movies. I know that sounds counterintuitive. It's not, actually. It's very intuitive. So today we have two short, enjoyable conversations. At least they were enjoyable for me, with two filmmakers. First up is Danny Boyle. He's probably best known for his early film, Trainspotting, but he's made a lot of movies since then. I mean, and successful movies, you know, 28 Days Later. The Fast zombie movie, that was pretty cool, and Sunshine, science fiction movie that he made most recently. And his new movie is called Slumdog Millionaire. It's about a kid growing up on the streets of Bombay, or Mumbai as it's called now, who finds his way after years of a difficult life, finds himself on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the game show. And doesn't just find himself there, but finds himself doing really well. And apparently drawing on his life experience, not his education, because it doesn't have any formal education, but on his life experience.
Are you ready? Yes.
Are you nervous?
Well, if this sounds like a silly premise, It is. It's based on a book, but it's very energetic, and it's a real crowd pleaser. And Danny Boyle himself is very energetic when he talks about it. I asked him what it was that drew him to this project.
It wasn't the novel, actually. It was my agent sent me this script, and he said it was a film about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And I remember thinking, I don't really want to make a film about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Who does?
And I wouldn't want to watch one about it either. And But I did read it because it was written by this guy, Simon Balfoy, who I'd heard of. I didn't know him personally, but he'd written the full Monty. He was a proper good writer.
Yeah.
So I thought, and I often think this, I think I should, out of respect, I should at least read a bit of it. You know, and you think maybe read half of it, whatever. And so that you can reply and make it sound like you read it all. And then I was lost after about 10, 15 pages. You know you're going to make that film. Full stop. And you don't even get to the end. You don't have to get to the end to know. Mm. And in fact, I often think getting to the end isn't necessarily a good thing, you know, to make a decision at that point, because you then it's about who you're going to cast and can we raise enough money and blah, 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 all those kind of things. So I was just knew I was in, really, after 10, 15 pages. And I've had that experience a couple of times before. But it wasn't based on the book. And then when I read the book is very, very different. And people should be aware of that if they're gonna, if they like the movie. But the book is very, very different. It's very rigid, the book. It's very, and it's a sign of how skillful Simon was in adapting it, is that he just used it as an opportunity to write about India. Obviously, the idea of a kid who goes on the show and uses his experience in life to answer the questions, which is fortuitous for him at the very least, that's central to the book, obviously, and is the entire book. But it's very rigid, the structure. And I think Simon knew, and certainly I knew, that you'd tire of that very quickly in the cinema. So he uses this very fluid sense of time where you go backward and forward in time, sort of like Usual Suspects in a funny kind of way, that you're kind of like, you just, and you don't quite know where you are sometimes, but it all feels like now.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like it's now. Yeah. And it's not important that you think, that you know it's 13 years ago. It all feels immediate, you know. That was always our idea with it. So that was what was attracted to it. In terms of, if I can just recommend to your readership a book, if they want to read a book about Mumbai, about Bombay, this city, to read this book, Maximum City, which is what people call the city. And it's by this guy, Suketu Mehta, who's he's Indian actually, but he lived in America. He was born and brought up in Mumbai until he was 16. And then he moved to New York with his family, was educated in New York from then on, became this incredibly brilliant writer, and went back and moved his family back when he was 30 to live in Mumbai again. Mm. And he writes this book about it called Maximum City. And that, I had that book with me every day on the set. I'd read bits of it at lunchtime, and amazing book. Nearly won the Pulitzer Prize, didn't quite. You read it, you think, how can this not win the Pulitzer Prize? Uh-huh. Anyway, so that would be my recommendation in terms of further reading.
Yeah. This idea of moving around in time reminds me a little bit of The Godfather Part 2 also, which has two timelines. But I remember Walter Murch talking about how they sort of, when they were editing, instead of jumping back and forth, they tried to let each one sort of come to a natural conclusion, even if it meant staying there for a while. And one of the things I heard most often about Slumdog Millionaire when I saw it in Toronto and talking to other people about it was how exciting it was and how much momentum it has. Yeah. What was your strategy for maintaining that momentum given that you're moving around in time?
I think it was the overall momentum was more important than the individual details, really, I guess, in terms of you wanted, so flashbacks, and they are flashbacks, I suppose. We didn't think of them as flashbacks, and they're not announced in the film as flashbacks. They're not like,
yeah,
you go back and then you're back forward again. We didn't really want that to interfere with the forward trajectory, really, because the central character, his motivation, I suppose I should give this away, really, his motivation to go on the show isn't the money, it's something else. And he has that forward momentum about that motivation. And so we wanted to reflect that in the way, we wanted to follow his character through it like that, even though you see him at a couple of different ages played by other people, obviously, someone who's 7 and someone who's 12, and then he's 18. So we wanted to, the overall momentum of his focus was more important than anything, really. And also life there is, it's lived very, very immediately. It feels like an immediate experience. It doesn't feel like something you reflect on or dwell on. You just live it, you know, and that's, so it felt very appropriate to make the film that way and let people try and experience it that way as well. Yeah. You know, it's not a cool, reflective city, Mumbai. It's a hot, passionate experience that you live out day by day. And if you make the most of it, if you go into it with the right approach, it's an incredibly generous city as well. Mm. You know, it will reward you 100-fold for that approach, you know.
Had you spent time there before making the movie?
No, I'd never been. My dad was there in the war and training to invade Japan, actually. A lot of British were there waiting to invade Japan. And I'd heard a lot about it, you know, obviously from friends and stuff, but I'd never been. I'm not really a traveler, really. I've always worked, you know. I went straight from college to work, and I didn't take a gap year to go on tour the world like my daughters do. And I've never done anything like that, you know. Yeah. So it's wonderful to make films, actually, because you get a chance to catch up and go and see places that all your mates have been after college. And but I never got to, no.
Huh. Since you mentioned Jamal's motivation, and since the word millionaire is in the title, it reminds me that there are a lot of sort of class issues that are beneath the surface of the film. He's not the only character who goes from being poor to being rich in the movie.
It's certainly something I'm obviously very interested in. I come from what people would call, certainly not in terms of anybody, someone like Jamal, but certainly in the West, I come from quite a poor background, really. And I've been very fortunate to have had to have made money, you know, because of the films. And so I own my own house. And but you never forget where you come from, and you never forget that journey, you know. And so I'm obviously very interested in that that quest, really. And also, but I'm also aware that I'm not very good with money either. I'm not like a money maker. You know, I'm not like, people can rip me off very easily because I don't really understand money, you know, in the way that you meet people who really know how money works, like producers. Yeah. I don't really understand how money works. I'm a bit of an innocent, really. Mm. And I've tried to get my head around it, and it just doesn't work for me, you know, and so I've stopped bothering, really. And I'm fortunate enough to have made enough money to live, so, and live well. So, but I've always been really, obviously, kind of instinctively and consciously interested in that process, really, by the way you get out of it. And I made a film, Millions, that had an idea in it that there was this kid who was very imaginative, and that's what mattered to him. Wasn't money. It was his imagination mattered, and because of his imagination, he got to meet up with his mum again, you know, and because he was open to stuff like that. And I've always loved that, you know. Those are the kind of things that interest me, you know, personally.
Loveline Tandon is credited as co-director on this film. What does that position mean, and what was her involvement?
She was extraordinary for me. She was the casting director originally. So you spend a lot of time, especially on a film like this, you spend a lot of time with your casting director casting and whatever. And I realized when I was working with her, particularly with the younger kids, that I was going to need her on the set the whole time. So I arranged for her to be on the set and to work with me, with the kids, initially on acting, you know, just on the acting front. And it was a big help because obviously she speaks Hindi and I don't, and the little kids tend to speak in Hindi mostly. And so that was a huge help practically like that. But I realized after a while that she was a proper director. You know, you can just tell she can do it, you know. And I would eventually send her off with the second unit, because the second unit, the stuff that was coming back from the second unit, you know, which was camera led, wasn't very good. In fact, it was terrible, actually. It was kind of everything I didn't want the film to be. So I sent her off with the second unit, and she was like, made a huge difference immediately. So we credited her as co-director because she deserves it. I mean, there was her, and there was another guy actually who gets a more conventional credit, the first assistant director, Raj Achari. And he was also he and Loveline were the biggest difference that was made to the film for me. Without them, it would have been a poorer film by a large percentage, you know. So you got to give them credit, you know.
Yeah. One of the things that surprised me in the movie was that when the police suspect that Jamal may have cheated at this game, they torture him.
Yeah.
They beat him, electrocute him. Torture's been talked about so much in recent years, it's hard not to see it depicted in a movie and assume that this is a part of that dialogue. Is the film making a comment on that at all?
Well, to be honest, not really, because what you have to do it really realistically, how it is in India, and this will give you an idea of it. There's a lot of bureaucracy in India to do with filmmaking. Everything has to pass the Indian film censor before you make the film, and then after you've made the film. So obviously that you're quite flexible with what's included in the film that you present to them. You don't reveal everything because they really wouldn't allow some things to happen. But the torture scene, because it takes place in a police station, we had to tell them about it up front. And their reaction, this is the official reaction that came back in a piece of paper, and they said, the torture scene was fine, provided nobody was involved above the rank of inspector. Huh. That tells you straight away that it's happening all the time.
Wow.
And they just didn't want anybody above the road. And in fact, then you go around the police stations. Having got permission, you're allowed to go around the police stations then and have a look around. And you can see the equipment they use. It's there. And you talk to the local guys and they say, well, if you get arrested for anything worse than a traffic offence, you've got a 50-50 chance that you'll be encouraged in your interviews with the liberal use of slapping, hitting, wow. you know, all that kind of stuff. So you have to concentrate on that, not on its obviously what's happened in the West, particularly in the last couple of years. So you can't use it to illustrate anything about the West. So in fact, although people don't laugh, and I think they don't laugh because of the reasons you're saying, mm-hmm. in fact, it's a comic scene really in a way, because it is laughable how it's used in a way. And but it's a very weird one to watch in the West at the moment, I know. And you can feel that in the audiences are watching it, because they don't really know what the story's going to be about. And they're seeing a torture scene and they're thinking, is this a comment on American society? Is this, you know, on American behavior or, but it's not meant to be in such, no.
Yeah, because it happens fairly early in the film.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Much later in the film, the same character says, your story is bizarrely plausible. And so what you've just said seems like that's true.
That's weird, that line. There's always somewhere in a film that a line gets a laugh that you never, ever dreamt in your wildest dreams that would ever get a laugh. There are certain other lines that you think are going to get laughs and never do. But me and Simon, the writer, we'd sit at the couple of first public screenings and that line gets a roaring laugh, you know, and you think, what? It's like bizarre, you know. Anyway, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. We thought about it. We said, well, they must be following it and it's so bizarrely implausible. It must be because it's so implausible what they've watched, but maybe, anyway.
Will the film be released in India?
It will. Ironically, Fox have just, and this gives you an idea, it'll give you a little glimpse of what's going on in India. Fox have just set up distribution there. Mm. So they're going to distribute the film in January, provided it passes the Indian censors. There's no guarantee that will happen, of course. It will be released in January in India, which we'll be delighted about. So they're working at the moment on a version where they dub everybody into Hindi. So that's being prepared at the moment. So that means they'll try and make it a wide-scale release, because there's English language films released all the time. There's a lot of people there speak English.
Yeah.
And
your actors spoke English.
They all speak English apart from the little kids, yeah. And people love watching Western movies as well as the Bollywood movies, you know. So they can certainly release it in English. But they're also, because they're going to dub it into Hindi, they're obviously hoping to actually make a bigger impact than that with it. So we'll see.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks very much.
Thanks. Earlier this year at Sundance, one of the biggest surprises that I had was walking into this movie called Ballast, completely blind, and discovering a movie that was seemingly inspired by the Dardenne brothers, Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne from Belgium. It seemed inspired by those movies and those guys, but it was set in Mississippi. So the camera was trained on a pocket of America that we don't often see in film. So I immediately wanted to sit down and talk with the director, Lance Hammer, about this, and so we did. So this interview is actually from January, but the movie is being released now. He's releasing it himself, just the way he made the film, you know, without compromising. He's releasing it the same way. And although he's inspired by the Dardennes, it's clear to me, after talking to him especially, that his interest was in depicting the people and the place. And the fact that he did this with so little compromise makes me really curious to see what he does next. But it's an excellent debut. Here's Lance Hammer.
I had an interest to make a story about the physical phenomenon of the Delta in the winter, and particularly my response emotionally to a sense of sadness that kind of has descended upon that place for many generations, and, you know, deals with suffering and brutality inflicted by the white establishment against black working force. Everybody knows about this, it's pretty obvious. And I was interested in responding to a tonal sensation of that, and not speaking intellectually on the level of, you know, about racial relations in that place, but just responding to the sadness that I felt. And I knew that film was kind of the way to capture that, because it includes the visual and the oral, you know, the audible components of, which is essentially silence in the Delta in the winter. So in order to convey that and have something that people would want to watch rather than just beautiful landscape shots and people in the landscape, I knew I had to create a structure. So I knew I was carrying this desire to make the Delta project for a long time, looking for a proper subject matter. And my girlfriend, Nicole Quaid, was telling me of her friends that were identical twins. And one of them walked up the stairs one day and found the window open and discovered that his brother had jumped out of the window and killed himself, suicide. And I was just astounded. I mean, just it totally blew me away that because my mother's an identical twin, and I know the psychic bond between identical twins. So at the moment, just the moment she told me that story, I realized this is what the story for the Delta is going to be. So that had the proper level of sadness and kind of grief that I think could do this region some justice. So
are you from Mississippi?
No, but I've been traveling there for like 10 years, the last 10 years, just when I was writing on another project in Tennessee and Kentucky area, driving around, and just kind of fell in love. It's a place, it's everything. It's joy. Every emotion in existence is there in abundance, but I responded particularly to this one thing and wanted to focus on this one kind of tonal aspect of the place.
Not being familiar with you or your work since this is your first film, there were parts of the movie where I was worried about where this was going to go, because there are lots of, there are guns and violence and drugs and dysfunction.
Right.
And yet you have a real belief in your characters, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I love these people. And I actually love the people that played the parts as well. And that's, if the movie works, it's because of those people, and it has very little to do with me. It has to do with them. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely fair to say I love these people and I care about them deeply. I put them into dire circumstances, but I want them to get out of it, you know? Mm-hmm. I want them to survive. I want them to be strong and be better for the experience.
How did you find the actors? They're non-professional actors, right?
No, none of them are, except Johnny McPhail, the white guy. He had some prior film experience, for a couple films that came through Mississippi, and he did some theater. Nobody else had, and that was critical. I wanted to make a film that was authentic to a place and had as much truth as humanly possible, and that was my goal, to convey the emotional truth of a place. And there was no other choice. I wouldn't entertain any other idea except to cast real people that had no experience in acting or in Hollywood or any sort of, you know, entertainment business, that from the exact locations that we were shooting in, and that would convey the truth. But, you know, I'm not from there. I can only take something so far, but I would have to give it to these people to own it at that point. And we could collaborate, but it would be, the truth would come emotionally from the story and that I obviously created, but ultimately from the natures of these people. And nobody, I don't understand the Delta. I've been there traveling for 10 years. It's very complicated, especially racially. You know, the racial relations in that place are notorious and historical and complicated as hell. And they understand it because they were born there. So I wanted them to carry all that information, you know, largely in their physical portrayals.
So in some ways, this is an exploration for you as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair statement.
Were they following a script?
They were, but they didn't really know it. I mean, no, they knew it. I didn't show them the script. On occasion, I would show them pages and scenes, and we talked about it, that this was the process that we would follow, because the language, the dialogue that I wrote in the script, you know, with screenwriting software and very traditional kind of thing, was always provisional, because the dialect and the idiom there are very particular and beautiful, and I don't know it, you know. So I wrote very lean, you know, provisional dialogue, and I always knew that only I would see that. And then through a very exhaustive rehearsal process, we would talk about scenario and in the locations, because we obtained the locations early, and we would go and rehearse for months in these locations, and I would discuss the scenes with them. They would make suggestions for improvements, or they'd say, I wouldn't do something like this, I would do it like this, and that was very often incorporated, and usually, you know, 90% of the time better. Areas in the film that move me are when that happened, and the language would come from them. And I would videotape the rehearsals, and every night I'd go back and transcribe the new what came, you know, and we would improvise and go into all kinds of crazy areas, and I'd have to make choices of which one I ultimately want to shoot. And then when we shot, improvisation was encouraged at all times in rehearsal and especially in production. And the camera was designed to follow that wherever it wanted to go, you know?
It's a movie that looks very casually observed, and yet I imagine there was more planning there than it seems.
It took me a very long time to make this film. I wrote it in like 2 years, took a long time to write it. Pre-production was long because of this very long rehearsal period, a lot of scouting that I've been doing for many years, and editing was, you know, a year and a half. And just so there's a lot of patience involved with this and very rigorous planning. But it was planning to build a structure upon which, you know, spontaneous events could occur. But they had to occur within the structure, and they had to be based upon that structure. And my greatest pleasure in the process, by far, was designing a structure upon which things could happen spontaneously, and then truly doing that. And as a director, I think that's what my role was. You know, I wasn't acting. They were doing it. They owned the parts, but I built the structure that they could explore within, and it worked pretty well.
You have a back. I think it works beautifully. It's one of those stories that it doesn't tell us everything right away. We have to just be patient and wait for it, as with life, or you know, watch and figure things out on our own. How these people are related, where they live, what the history is, because there is a history there.
Yeah.
Even if it's not all spelled out. I think that's really great.
Thank you.
Do you have a background in film production, but not as a filmmaker, is that right?
As an art director, yeah.
Art director?
And I'm an architect. I was trained as an architecture. So, I mean, I think that's probably, you know, that's the design process I took to this project. It's basically an architectural design process. Yeah.
You'd think that an art director directing his first film would have a flashy, more artificial look than Bialas does.
Yeah, you know, I worked in Hollywood on big stuff, and the craftsmen and the artisans in Hollywood are brilliant. They're truly the top of the field in all aspects, in every field. But the films suck.
Yeah.
They're just absolute, utter shit. And this film, in a lot of ways, was a reaction to that. So I wanted to make something as humble and realistic and unadorned as possible. As an art director, my eye was constantly thinking of production design. But there's nothing more beautiful than existing locations in Mississippi. So we found two existing houses that were not being lived in, and we did some work to them just to make them look as if they were being lived in, but at all times it was just taking elements from other houses that we'd found and just transporting to this one, and we painted them, you know, and it was too much to paint them in retrospect, you know. They're loud. But other than that, you know, it's all existing location. The store, we just walked into it, you know. And we added some potato chips that were some product placement things that we got for free. And that was it. And that's beautiful. I mean, there's nothing more beautiful than that, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And simple and inexpensive, by the way. I mean, that's a factor.
There's that scene in the store, speaking of the store, where the boy is, he's sort of copying a playing card while his mom and uncle are having a conversation about him. And they're in this sort of haze in the background, and the focus is on him in the foreground.
Right. We just set it up. I mean, it's Lal Crawley is the cinematographer and my very vital collaborator in every aspect, not just photographic, but everything. We operated basically as one person, and he's a brilliant, brilliant creative mind. That was the script, you know. The boy was drawing a card, and Jamiron actually drew that image, and the scene was about him and his listening to somebody. I mean, this is from Godard, right? Like, Godard likes to, he says, point the camera at people that are listening and not talking, and everything is in that person listening. You know, every emotional conveyance is there, and I need to do much more of this. It's just, I threw it up there with Lal, said, I want the camera to be on him, I want a rock around his head, don't pull focus to them, let's try it and see how it works. And we tried it once, and it rocked, so, or it didn't. I mean, it rocked him because Jamiron's performance is just, that kid is amazing, and I didn't give him any direction. You know, I just said, here's what we're going to do in this scene, and the camera's going to be on you and behind you. Respond as you would respond. And the way he moves his eyes up at the right time, just after, I mean, he's only concentrating on the Jack of Hearts, and then at the right moment, he stops drawing and listens to, I don't know, just one of those things that happened. We kept it quiet. Maybe some people might even miss the background language, but this is Skywalker, which is Kent Sparling and Julia Shire, who did the whole film themselves, in an extremely naturalistic way. Everything was really recorded on synced to camera, or we went back and recorded in the same spots again to pick up stereo ambiences and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they did a brilliant job, you know. They're the best.
It just really captures that moment of, or that thing that kids do, where they're always around adults, mm-hmm. and hearing things that the adults aren't really speaking to them, but you know they're aware of what's going on.
But you see, this is a testament of these actors again. Like Jamiron and all the actors were thoroughly in their you know, it's not their character, but because they were themselves responding as they would respond in artificial scenarios. So I would say here's the scenario I'm going to impress upon your lives, and I want you to respond this way. And we'd done this for months and months, so they truly inhabited the characters, and that was Jamiron. That's how he would respond if his mother was talking about drugs and getting beat up on. And you know, it's true. I didn't tell him to do that, you know. Yeah. So if there's little moments like that, which to me are the most important things, all the little things, those are the actors responding truthfully.
Were you ever tempted to add music?
I was, I confess. I wrote the script and went all through production knowing I was not going to use music and having a lot of faith in it, but being very worried about it. And telling, when people had asked me, who's going to do the score? Oh, probably nobody, but maybe blah, 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 blah. Just because I didn't have a lot of confidence saying that, but I knew I was going to do it, you know. And then I cut it, and it's such a lonely process. And so, I'm very prone to self-doubt and self-criticism, and music is your crutch. So I fought to not have it, and then I tried it. I put in a brilliant band, Silver Mountain Zion. They're from Canada. Talked to them about doing the score. They were into it. And then I started cutting it in a little bit, and it was powerful, but it overwhelmed the silence. And this film had to be silent. It had to be about the silence of the Delta, and the emotion had to be conveyed by the characters and nothing else, in silence. And you know, I owe obviously a big debt to Dardenne and a lot of the European filmmakers, you know, Eric Zonka, just so many people that have the bravery to just say, this is about these people, music has nothing to do with these people. And I'm a musician, you know, music is extremely important to me. So in the end, I hope it worked. It could bore people, I don't know.
I had the good fortune of walking into it completely cold. I had no idea what it was, who made it, what it was about, nothing. Mm-hmm. And immediately thought, oh, this seems like it's inspired by La Promesse or Le Fils or L'Enfant, and that's great, except it's a completely different location, different people, and different story. And
those guys are hugely important to me, and they're masterful, and there's one very specific overt kind of reference, and it's the motorcycle to La Promesse and Rosetta. Right. and that was on purpose, you know. It worked really well in the story, but I didn't, you know, I'm not interested in being derivative, but I've learned to be courageous through them, you know, because thankfully they are so courageous.
Yeah. And,
that's the debt I owe them.
Do you have any other projects in the works?
I do. I have a lot of things that I'm writing a lot of things. I have one in particular, it's called The Imperfect Cell, and Mark Johnson and Amy Shea are producing that. It's been around for a while. It's bigger scale, a little bit. You know, it's definitely independent. That was happening before this. And I got very frustrated with the world of agents and actors and all of that, and said, fuck you, I'm making this instead. I mean, not to the producers. Mark and Amy are wonderful. And Mark and Amy were both executive producers on this. Andrew Adamson as well. They're all producers on this next one as well. So they are very generous and patient with me, and hopefully I can get that one off the ground in the next few months. We did get it off the ground already, but it stopped for a couple of reasons, and hopefully we'll pick it up.
Sure, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. If you have a comment for us, you can find us on the web at dailyplastic.com. There you'll find other episodes in this series of podcasts, other interviews, and discussions about movies. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, call 1-415-287-4020. That's 415-287-4020. Record your message and we'll get it. We'll be back next time with more stuff.
Bye.